Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad that you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, another edition of Prairie Plates. Bert Myers, co-owner of Dempsey's Public House and Beer and Fish Company in downtown Fargo, joins Rick Guillon in the Main Street studio to discuss St. Patrick's Day celebrations, including making 800 pounds of corned beef. And of course, there'll be live Irish music too. And we begin Main Street today thinking about National Single Parents Day, which is March 21st, and Women's History Month. Are you interested in learning more about the Jeremiah program? Well, we have the guest just for you. Leticia Miserio Hellerud is the executive director of the Jeremiah program's Fargo-Moorhead campus, and she's a seasoned leader with over 27 years of experience advocating for minority communities, advancing equity-driven policies, and fostering systemic change across the upper Midwest. Leticia, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me, Craig.
Really honored that you are with us today. I want to begin by talking about the reality of single motherhood today and have you talk about how rising costs of living, lack of affordable childcare, and limited access to higher education are making it more challenging for single moms right here in our area to advance.
Well, that's actually a question that I can answer from a first-person experience, personal experience. I was a single mom for 14 years, and it was very difficult. And I also work with a single mom today, so I have stories on every single day of how difficult this is. And yet my story and the story of the Single Mom at Jeremiah program are not isolated. We have more than 80% of, single parent families that are headed by single mothers in the United States. So, and most of them live in poverty. And I was one of them. And the moms in Jeremiah program are part of that statistics. So when you think about what you have to juggle as an adult, like without even children, work and, if you are in school, add school to that. But different things that you need to be juggling as an adult. So when you are doing that as a single parent, as a single mom, the burden is heavier. So there's a cost that keeps rising, it's hard to get by. Most moms, single moms, also work low-paying jobs because they don't have access to higher education because they have to take care of the children. So everything is interconnected. And so you need childcare to be able to go to work. You need to be able to afford childcare, and you can't go to work without being able to basically to have your children cared for. You can't go to school to get a better job, get a degree, and get better opportunities. So it becomes like a vicious cycle. As a single mom, you are really struggling every single day. And most of the time, the blame is put on you. So you don't always get support. If you're not lucky to have family to bail you out, sometimes if you cannot afford even, food or rent or car repair, it becomes unbearable.
So how do you then, through the Jeremiah program, first, let us know what that is, and how do you support both mothers and their children to try to disrupt this generational poverty that you've talked about, simultaneously making investments in both generations? How do you do that?
Jeremiah program, the focus is single moms who have young children, especially. So you have to have at least one child under the age of 5. We are a nonprofit organization that is supporting a single mom, pursue their personal and professional goals, but while they are also taking care of their children. So how we partner with these single moms is to help them with foundational needs like housing and, healthcare for their children, and also support them complete college. We know that college education is not a guarantee to succeed in life, to have a better job. But we also know that it's a very significant lever. So we know from experience that moms who have received that support, are able to get better jobs and are also able to support their families and have a bigger impact on society. So for over 25 years, JP has been helping single moms in our program complete college while providing housing, childcare, quality early childhood education, and career-focused coaching. And we, when we do that, by supporting both moms and the children, we are helping to disrupt the cycle of generational poverty and helping these families succeed long-term.
You have on-site child development centers in Fargo. Why is it so important, and why does that really allow for a strong foundation for lifelong learning?
Well, in North Dakota especially, but really across the United States, childcare and early childhood education opportunities are very rare. It's a crisis in North Dakota. And so it's hard to get ahead in life when you are in charge of little ones, your children, and when you cannot get support with that. You know, there are people who may have the means to pay for, you know, like a good preschool program or good quality childcare, and who are unable to find space. So we know that capacity is an issue in our state. But we also know that, especially in the case of single moms, they don't even have, most of them don't have the means, the financial means to afford a good quality early childhood development center. So we think that it's important not only to support the moms to succeed in their education, to succeed with their career goals, but also their children to be able to get the foundation that they need to compete with their peers, you know, who have access to quality early childhood education. And we know that investing in 0 to 5 has really like an impact in how successful they are in their pre-K through 12 education and in life.
We are enjoying our conversation with Leticia Mazzaro-Hellyrood in honor of National Single Parents Day. Leticia is the executive director of the Jeremiah Program's Fargo-Moorhead campus. And before we get to the empowerment and leadership training that you offer, I want to learn more about the safe and affordable housing that you have right on your campus. It's a residential campus. It must enable mothers and their children really to grow and have a better chance at success.
You're right. So we will talk about empowerment and leadership training, but really when you think about safe and affordable housing, that's another area where there is a really huge gap in terms of access if you don't have the means to pay for it. So for us, having a safe, affordable housing for our moms is foundational. Because we know that in our area in Fargo, many single moms are struggling with housing insecurity and high rent costs. And for us, providing that safe and stable, you know, foundation helps to reduce stress and allow moms to focus on education and their career growth. So we know that if the moms are in a stable housing, this leads to higher graduation rates, and it does improve overall well-being for the families. So that's why it should not be a privilege to be able to live in a place that allows you to succeed in life, because when you do better on your own goals and the community benefits.
I have to believe that you have more demand than facilities available for people who really need it. Is that true, unfortunately, here in Fargo?
It is true, unfortunately. And this is also even more true today, as we worry that some of these safety nets that some of the moms had are at risk with the current administration. So we know that the moms that we have right now, there is a waiting list. And the need for a program like Jeremiah is real. The need is real, and we have more moms who need to partner with us and be able to go to college and be able to raise their families and not having to choose between getting ahead and taking care of their children. So we right now are working at finding partners like in the community with safe, affordable housing for the moms, because we can support them with, you know, all the other services that we provide, like one-on-one coaching, like helping them build a supportive community of sisterhood, and support their children to grow. But we have limited space, and we are looking for those partners. So if anyone is listening, and you think that you would be a good partner to us, please reach out.
We touched on empowerment and leadership training just for a moment a bit ago. How are you able to help single mothers build confidence, deconstruct false narratives, and really author their own agency?
So like empowerment leadership training is a prerequisite before the moms decide to partner with us. And we know that society puts a big stigma on single motherhood, and we know that these moms have not necessarily been empowered to step in their agency and to believe in themselves. So through this curriculum, you know, the moms are supported to build confidence and to also deconstruct false narratives, and to start authoring their own agency. So the program, this curriculum, helps the mothers really feel like, remember basically who they are, and, you know, strong, you know, resilient, you know, capable, and hardworking, all of these things that sometimes, you know, hardships and false narratives can make you forget. So through this program, they learn to be their best advocate. They learn to build skills that will continue to help them navigate more challenges. And they also learn that truly it's not their fault. You know, like if they are struggling as single moms, that really the responsibility goes on the lack of systems that can support them, because they have all, you know, like they have the willingness, they have the strength, they have the resilience, they have all the things, the determination, all the things that can make them succeed. So through the empowerment leadership training, they learn to recognize their strengths and capabilities, and that lay another strong foundation for them to move forward more confidently in life.
How do you know what you do works? I'm guessing you have a truckload, I hope, of alumni success stories, women who have completed their education, secured stable employment, and provided a better future for their children and themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. That's a very good question. We do track, you know, how well what we're doing, you know, whether what we're doing is working or not. So the Fargo-Moorhead campus opened its door, like the physical facility, in 2018, but the programming started much earlier, 2014, I think. So and throughout 2023, I don't have the final report for 2024, but I can tell you that throughout 2023, 72% of the moms that were in the program persisted in their college, career, and leadership journeys. And we also had 93% of the moms in our program who reported that coaching, working one-on-one with a coach, helped them progress towards their education goals. We had 155 moms and children who participated in our two-generation programming in different capacities. And we also had like 44 children who benefited from our high-quality learning in the on-site child development center. We have more numbers, really, that shows that what we're doing is, taking the moms in our program from point A to point B. We had 25 families who benefited from the safe and affordable housing that we have here on campus. And I wish I had the numbers of our children who participated in our summer enrichment programs, but it's a very high percentage, almost 100% of the eligible children. So we know that all these, metrics tell a story, but really the most impactful story is to see the moms every single day in this building, to see them celebrate good grades, to see them celebrate, finishing successfully a semester, and to see them graduate. And we also know that these moms work in the community. We have nurses, we have, moms who work in, thinking about different professions. Dental hygienist is one of them. We have moms who are, working in different fields, and all those, their success really has a ripple effect in the community, because they are supporting, the needs of the community through their chosen careers.
There's a young woman who's listening and wondering, I think they could help me. What should they do? And then what should they expect in the process of trying to secure services from the Jeremiah program?
So I would encourage them, if it's a young woman who is at least 18 years old, who has a high school diploma or GED, who has the desire to go to college or who is already in college, and also has at least one child under the age of 5, and they have at least 50% custody of that child, I would encourage them to go on jeremiahprogram.org and apply to start the process through, apply for the empowerment and leadership training. And that is what builds the pipeline for the program at the end of that course. So they can decide if they want to continue the journey. They don't have to decide then, but this is something that's going to help them, whether they stay with decide to partner with Jeremiah at the end of the 12 weeks or not. This is something that's going to really impact them in a very positive way, because we hear that from our moms, even long after they have graduated. And I know that we're not only being listened to by people in the Fargo-Moorhead area, so it's important for me to say that GMI program is a national organization, and that we have, campuses or offices in 9 cities across the United States. So Austin, Texas, Baltimore, Maryland, Boston, Massachusetts, Brooklyn, New York, Fargo, Fargo-Moorhead, Fargo, North Dakota, Moorhead, Minnesota, Las Vegas, Nevada, Minneapolis, Rochester, and St. Paul. Those last 3 cities are in Minnesota.
I'm guessing you have plans to grow and have ideas for new initiatives. How do you aim to continue supporting single mothers in achieving economic mobility, perhaps as you try to expand?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we are currently serving around 50 moms. We have 20 units, like fully furnished apartments, but we also have moms who don't live on the campus and who live in the community. And that's the silver lining, if you will, from COVID. When we had, the rest of the world to do most, if not all, the programming virtually. So we realized that if we have moms who already have secured housing, or if we can help them secure housing, outside this building that we could they could still benefit the rest of the programming, the one-on-one coaching, the community of sisterhood, the child development center, if they need that, and if they don't have that already secured. So we know that that helps them really persist through college. So we are adding coaches this year. That's what we are planning for, adding two coaches. And that means really doubling the numbers that we are currently serving. Our coaches have a caseload of 20 moms per coach. And right now, as I said, we have over 50, so we are already a little bit over the ratio that, you know, like produces the best, you know, outcome, if you will, and, you know, prevents burnout. So by adding two coaches, we are going to be impacting double the numbers. The numbers that I gave from 2023, in 2024, we know that we did much better than that because we keep, improving. Like we keep improving, but we also keep meeting the moment by supporting the moms who come through our doors.
As we wrap up our conversation, what would you hope listeners think about when they learn that it's National Single Parents Day this Friday?
So I really hope that listeners understand that we know at GMI program, we know that single parents are very strong and very resilient and very capable. And we hope that the narrative starts shifting. And we hope that not only these moms, as they re-author their stories, that they are shifting the narrative, but we want to invite people to start really seeing these single parents, single moms, as asset to the community. So I really hope that they find ways to support them better and to advocate for better systems, to talk to lawmakers and make sure that we are continue making laws that really recognize this, this group that has not always been supported adequately. And we hope also that our alumni, as they go in the community and do great things, that they also continue to advocate and continue to show that that single moms are very, very hardworking and a huge asset to society.
My guest today has been Leticia Nazario in front of National Single Parents Day, which is this Friday, March 21st. Leticia is the executive director of the Jeremiah program here in Fargo-Moorhead. Their mission sounds simple, but it's very complex, and that is to help single moms invest in themselves to thrive and take steps towards economic mobility. Leticia, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much and best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Coming up in the second half of today's show, Bert Myers, co-owner of Dempsey's Public House and Beer and Fish Company in downtown Fargo, joins Rick Gion in the Main Street studio to discuss St. Patrick's Day celebrations, including making 800 pounds of corned beef. Of course, there'll be live Irish music too. That's ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
Some barbecue,
applesauce, and some nice red beets.
There's the music that tells us it's Wednesday here on Main Street, and it's also time for Prairie Plates with Rick Gion. Rick, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig. How are you this week?
Hey, I'm doing very well, Rick. Of course, it's baseball season now, right? We've had a couple Major League Baseball games in the books already. Those Dodgers handled the Cubs, and now we are ready to head on for spring. And one thing that we always think about in spring is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. And you have a guest, Bert Myers, in the Main Street studio. He's with us today. He's one of the owners of Dempsey's Public House and Beer and Fish Company here in downtown Fargo. Bert, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks a lot for being here. You guys are cooking up 800 pounds of corned beef for the holiday. And I think, I have two questions. All right. Isn't every day St. Patrick's Day at Dempsey's? And then B, what's the process for getting it just right with 800 pounds of corned beef?
Well, every day is St. Patty's Day at Dempsey's. We cook overnight the night before St. Pat's. I have lots of ovens at Beer and Fish, so I'm able to do that.
How do you cook all of that? Do you have different large roasting pans, or how does that all work? With do you cook the meat first and then the vegetables and then all? What's the procedure?
Well, we cook the roasts in big roasting pans and then hotel pans, stainless steel hotel pans with just coke and water and the seasoning packets, and then saran and foil them and just load the thing up. You know, the ovens are just completely loaded to the hilt. So
tell me, Bert, what is corned beef? What is it?
Well, it's basically brined in a heavy salt solution. That's about it. And then they put the corning stuff in there, the mix of packet, the spices, you know. It's like pickling spice. And then they take and literally just soak it for 2 weeks. And we did corn our own 1 year, and my stepfather did it, and he screwed it all up because he thought salt was too expensive. So we couldn't even serve it. We didn't even, that year, we just were a bust. But you soak it for weeks, like 2 weeks.
And usually it's beef brisket, but at the old Hodo, they used to have a corned beef bison tongue sandwich. And
really?
They corned those bison tongues themselves. And the chefs at the time, this was like 10 years ago, and it was Chef Ryan actually from Luna. And he showed me like a dozen bison tongues being corned back in the Hodo. And so, yeah, they soaked those, I think, for 2 or 3 weeks. And yeah, it's that pickling spice. It's a brine solution. It's different things like that. And then they would braise them, like you said, in Coke. And I don't think they use Coke, but Coca-Cola is kind of your secret, isn't it?
Yeah, my mom's did it since I was a kid, so I just put it in there. Any meat I cook, turkey, whatever, Coke goes in it.
Interesting.
Hey, Rick, can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
Did you have some of the bison tongue, and what was it like?
That was one of my favorite corned beef sandwiches I have ever had, because they made the bread, they made the sauerkraut, and they didn't make the cheese. But yes, that bison tongue corned beef sandwich was really, really good.
Yeah, that sounds wild.
It was.
I'd like to try that.
And I also tried Bert's corned beef and cabbage on Monday, and I can tell you it's a hit, and it sells out. You got to get to Dempsey's early. Usually I get there about 11:15, and I'll tell you what, it sells out in a couple hours, so... they're having it again on this Saturday after the big St. Patrick's Day parade in downtown Fargo.
Bert, what's your history with Dempsey's?
Well, we started it in 2006. I used to have the restaurant Bertrosa's. I did that for many years, and I ended up selling that to my brother-in-law, and we opened Dempsey's when the Z license came available.
Why an Irish pub?
Well, we're Irish and German. That's where the Worst Beer Hall came.
I understand you're having some music playing on St. Patrick's Day. What kind of atmosphere are we going to see when we come through the doors?
It's Pachin, and they play two shows that day, and it's pretty fun, festive, you know, the bang your glass on the table.
Yeah, usually the fiddle player will get up on the bar sometimes, and that's
Alex.
It's a lot. Yeah, Alex. And it can be a lot of fun, and it's very festive. You start with in the morning with chocolate donuts, right?
And chocolate donuts and Guinness.
And Guinness. And it's just a fun time. Monday, I was there. I plan to go there on Saturday a little bit, spend some time. And, it's just a fun day. It's a lot of people in there.
Yes.
It's the spot to be at, I think.
So tell me, how do you relate the Irish culture the other 364 days of the year?
We do have the Irish band once a month there. And that kind of brings it back always, you know. The center of the universe is what some customers say for Dempsey's.
You know, Dempsey's also has some Chicago elements to it, too. You have an affinity towards Chicago. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we were born in Chicago, and we've always visit there every year. And my buddy had an Irish pub there, too, so that we kind of hung out in for many, many years. And that was probably an influence to do the Dempsey's, too.
And then you have Chicago hot dogs on Thursdays, and then those beefs.
What we used to sell at Bertrosa's, the Chicago Italian beef and hot dogs. It's free hot dog with a drink purchase on Thursdays, and then the beefs you have to pay for.
But they're $9, so it's not too bad. And you can get extra giardiniera. I always get extra giardiniera because I like them a little spicy and a little au jus. And I know that's not traditional, but and I like a little... horseradish on there too, but maybe that's a little Fargo flavor thrown in there. I don't know.
That's Fargo style. We dip ours, so.
I like them dipped too sometimes, and I do get on Thursdays a Italian beef and a Chicago hot dog because I usually order a beer, an old style or something like that, and then it's kind of a Chicago thing for me too, I guess.
Bert and Rick, fish fries are certainly a big tradition here in the Midwest. What makes them so popular? And then how does the Beer and Fish Company put its own spin on them?
Let me start out just talking a little bit of background with Lent. And it's basically roots in Catholicism, not eating meat from like warm-blooded animals on Fridays. And so fish fries became really popular here in the Midwest because a lot of folks, German descent, Polish descent, various descents are Catholic, and so these fish fries got really popular. And my experience with fish fries started in Wisconsin, in Wausau, Wisconsin, at a place called The Loading Zone, and they had fish fries every Friday. And I really, that was when I was a teenager, and I really thought it was cool, and I came back to Fargo, and no one really had fish fries. But actually, Bert here started fish fry at Worst Beer Hall when they own that. And so that's a little bit of my experience with fish fries, and I really enjoy it. And I go to Bert's restaurant, Beer and Fish, quite a bit. So it's an honor to have him on because not only does he own it, but he does cook back there like 6 or 7 days a week, I think. Right, Bert?
I try only six, but sometimes that doesn't happen.
I understand you have no secrets when it comes to cooking, Bert. So what are your best tips for frying fish to perfection?
Well, get the fish as dry as possible before it gets to that fryer is important. It's got to be, you know, when you pat it down with towels and stuff and make sure. And then I put a pre-dip on it, which is a batter, you know, just a powder batter. And then I let that sit for a bit, and then I put it into the beer batter and fry it.
And that seems to be a technique that's widely used, yeah, to have that powder of flour, or I think you put a little breadcrumb in there too, right?
We put the breadcrumb in just the panko one.
Okay.
We used to put a little breadcrumb on it, and we stopped doing that.
That's what I thought.
We put more just a straight powder on it now with a little bit of cornmeal in it.
Oh.
So.
Well, that's a good tip out there.
Yeah, and just get that dry and then throw it into the 375 or 350, whatever you prefer, oil, and make sure your oil's good and clean.
Is there options that are most popular here in this region, Bert?
Well, walleye is crazy. I mean, we do probably 400 pounds of it a week, or close to in the summertime for sure, 400 pounds of walleye a week. And the finger, it's the fingers, walleye fingers people love, so.
And it's a family operation, Craig, and his dad, John, is back there filleting a lot of walleye every day. And John's 85, and that's really cool. And then his brother Klaus makes a lot of the bread there. And it's just kind of a fun family operation. And they've been doing this stuff for quite a long time, right, Bert?
Yes. And my dad, yeah, he fillets all the walleyes. That's his job.
And I noticed you guys, well, last night I stopped in and you had a big halibut. So you caught a lot of this fish up. You,
yes,
fillet it up and talk about how you
get... He was getting in my way last night. Sorry.
He was pretty excited. That talk a little bit about that halibut that came in.
Yeah, we got two halibuts yesterday. One was 90-some pounds. One was, I think, 94 pounds. They were gigantic. It's like they came in big coffins. I fillet all those myself, and my dad likes to get involved in it for some reason, but he kind of destroys them.
Is it tough for you to source all the fish that you need?
No, it's not too bad. The fish guys out of Minneapolis, they get my halibut for me, and I get halibut from Fortune Fish, so I get it 4 days a week, and they deliver on different days, so... And I get all my oysters from the fish guys. They sourced them out of the East Coast for me, and they just fly them in every day. I order them every day, and they come the next day.
And I've had a lot of those oysters, and there's actually an oyster happy hour for those looking for a good deal, but I don't know if I should throw that out there.
Oh, that's fine. Come on in.
But it's from 4 to 6, I think, Monday through Friday, and you get $2
oysters? $2 oysters, yes.
And these oysters are fresh. They're good, and they're the premium ones that people look for. So what are some of the varieties? I know there's sweet petites and blue points.
Yeah. We don't do a lot of Blue Points anymore, but we do. I like the ones from Canada the best. I don't know why, but they seem to be the best oysters for me.
Maybe that cold water makes them sweet. I don't know.
We got Norumbega. There's Bass Point. And then there's some out of Nantucket, which are real good, and there's small ones.
Bert, I'm going to make you order just one seafood or fish item on your menu this afternoon. Only one. You can have anything you want, but you only get one choice there. What are you gonna order? What's your favorite?
Mine is halibut, just beer battered halibut with cocktail sauce and tartar together.
Rick, how
delicious.
About you?
Hey, halibut's great. I like traditional cod. It's kind of an English thing. I really like three-piece cod with the fresh-cut fries, because they do fresh-cut fries, and that's kind of the fish and chips thing. And then I do a walleye sandwich I enjoyed, and that's beer batter, and I get that with a salad for lunch, and that's also really good. But they also, fresh-cut the fries. You don't find that too often around here. Bert, talk about that a little bit. What's the process there?
Well, we do a potato. It's called a chipperack or whatever. It's made specifically for frying in fryers, and so you don't have to pre-soak them or nothing like that. They used to be so much more difficult. So what we do is we chop them down, fry them once, and then cool them, and then you fry them when they go to the customers. You have to get them cold again, and then they go out. But they used to be just a pain in the butt, those fries. But you used to have to brine them, literally take them in salt water and soak them overnight, then get that dried, then fry them, then cool them, and then put them back and then on their final fry. But it's awesome.
The fries are really good, and double blanch method is what they would call that technically, with frying them once. And then when I used to work in restaurants, I had to do that. And the fry gets really crispy on the outside. It's fluffy on the inside. It's just delicious. And yeah, I mean, not a lot of people do these fresh cut fries around here. And I just, when I see that, I'm like, yes, I'm going to go there. So what else on the menu do you think is really good? Like, you serve for Lent, like do you have lobster and certain things like that, or crab legs?
Yeah, well, the crab legs they can't source right now, the king crab, but we have lobster, the shrimp, of course, walleye, cod, halibut, what else? Mahi-mahi tacos. And one of my favorite dishes is that fire pasta, that shrimp fire pasta. That's a good Lent. That's a delicious dish.
That's really good stuff. What's it like being in the food service for as long as you have? You and your brother have been in the food service for how long?
Since we were little kids. I mean, my mom had restaurants, small little cafes and stuff, and her fish fry was actually really famous on the Iron Range. It was a big fish fry. She did it for many years. She failed at a couple restaurants, and then she finally had success at the Rose's Twin Lake Family Restaurant in Marble, Minnesota. And we worked there since we were young. She bought it from the old owner, and we did dishes for him before that. So
this is really a legacy that runs in the family.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But she was the fish fry lady. And then one time my brother missed, she had a place in Buck Lake, he missed work, didn't make it up there, and she made him hitchhike to work at 14.
Our guest has been Bert Myers. He's been in the Main Street studio with Rick Gion in this edition of Prairie Plates. Bert, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Rick, have a great St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, it'll be a fun at the parade on Saturday, and then I'll be going to Dempsey's for some corned beef and cabbage. Ka-dum, ka-dum, ka-dum. I've been listening to your show on the radio,
and you seem like a friend to me. You're listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that, too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spends adult album alternative music during the week? There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play. He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m. Listen, but the DJ, won't you play?
why climate change means fewer satellites. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it would undo 31 landmark regulations, many of which protect clean air. Another action would narrow the application of the Clean Water Act, reducing the amount of wetlands and waterways safeguarded from pollution.
That move was criticized by the environmental group American Rivers for threatening reliable drinking water for tens of millions of Americans and was viewed as a step back in time to when rivers were on fire.
The EPA administrator, former Congressman Lee Zeldin, also announced that the agency will rewrite rules that currently limit air pollution from fossil-fueled power plants, as well as from vehicle emissions.
Among the 31 actions, Zeldin celebrated rescinding the determination that the greenhouse gas carbon dioxide is a danger to public health. He referred to that finding as the holy grail of what he called the climate change religion.
As Inside Climate News explains, the dismantling of these rules could take up to 2 years. The EPA will need to draft new regulations, receive public comments, and come up with some scientific record justifying their actions, but with fewer staff due to recent firings and budget cuts.
Last week, the Supreme Court rejected the request of 19 Republican attorneys general who wanted to block lawsuits brought against oil companies in state courts for financial damages from climate change.
5 states, Minnesota, California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, have sued the corporations, including ExxonMobil, BP, and the American Petroleum Institute, a lobbying group for the industry.
Some of the claims allege that the fossil fuel companies have deceived the public for decades about the contributions of greenhouse gas emissions on global warming. It's the second time this year that the Supreme Court turned away this type of case.
And last week, nearly 200 environmental groups sounded the alarm that the fossil fuel industry may try to get Congress to pass legislation granting them immunity from being sued, similar to what gun manufacturers have obtained, as the number of new state laws aimed at making oil giants pay grows.
Vermont and New York have passed bills that are modeled on the U.S. Superfund program, and 10 other states are considering such legislation.
There are some 11,000 satellites above the Earth that facilitate global communications, navigation, weather forecasting, and banking. That number is expected to grow rapidly, with as many as 70,000 being launched over the next 5 years.
Suffice it to say, it's getting crowded in the upper atmosphere, and there aren't garbage trucks picking up dead satellites and other debris, ranging from old booster rockets, lost tools, and even paint flecks that can cause severe damage to spacecraft.
Once out of commission, satellites are either catapulted into a so-called graveyard orbit, thousands of miles above the Earth, or allowed to fall toward the surface, burning up on their way down.
But because of climate change, the number of satellites above the planet could be limited. MIT researchers have found that greenhouse gas emissions are causing the upper atmosphere, called the thermosphere, to shrink, leaving not only less space for future satellites, but also making the ones already up there less able to fall to Earth.
While greenhouse gases warm Earth's lower atmosphere, they cool the thermosphere and make it less dense. That decreased density reduces atmospheric drag, a force that pulls old satellites and other debris earthward, where they encounter air molecules and incinerate.
Less drag means more space junk is going to pile up, reducing the areas to launch new satellites and making the likelihood of collisions ever greater. The researchers predict that by the year 2100, the most viable locations to orbit Earth could be reduced by nearly two-thirds. And finally, the proverb, all's fair in love and war, could be on the mind of the male blue-lined octopus as he begins to make his move with the female of his species.
The palm-sized octopus, which lives in shallow reefs and tide pools on the east coast of Australia, needs to be calculating. not because the ladies are twice his size, but because she plans to eat him after they mate.
In all fairness, lead author Wensung Chung says eating males helps females to acquire the energy needed to produce eggs and then incubate them.
So what's an octopus to do? Paralyze her. That's according to researchers at the University of Queensland who observed a male biting the aorta of a female and injecting a venom, causing her to turn pale and her breathing to slow.
Within an hour, she returned to normal, but not before the male had transferred his sperm and made his getaway.
The researchers note that the neurotoxin disabled the female only temporarily, but warn people that all octopuses are venomous, so they can ward off prey, and humans should keep their distance.
That said, this call to arms between the two sexes of blue-lined octopus is a bit confounding, as both are believed to mate only once and die shortly after.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 19th. It's basketball tournament time. For over 100 years, basketball has been a cornerstone of North Dakota's sporting scene, uniting players, fans, and entire communities in the pursuit of victory. Join us as we celebrate the history of basketball in the region through Dakota Datebook. In November 1903, a brief in the Fargo Forum mentioned that Tower City had developed a lot of basketball enthusiasm. And it was true. Tower City developed and supported several strong, even renowned, basketball teams over the years. The high school girls' basketball team was the first to truly make a mark. In 1907, they went undefeated and ended Valley City's three-year winning streak when they faced them. For the next few years, the team remained strong in competitions. In 1915, the Tower City boys team stepped into the spotlight, winning their first state championship with a 24-13 victory over Minot. A picture of the seven young men, along with their coach and manager, appeared in the Fargo Forum after their victory. The newspaper reported, "This is the Tower City basketball team, champions of North Dakota, who won their title in a clean-cut, decisive manner after a season of victories. In the final tournament at Grand Forks, Tower City won by decisive scores against both the Bismarck and Minot teams." The Bismarck Tribune noted, "Close guarding and wonderful basket shooting featured the game. Minot was outplayed at every stage. Tower City displayed clever teamwork throughout." Their coach, Harry Haggard, former Fargo High School and college basketball star, was credited with imbuing his boys with something of that fighting spirit, which is characteristic of Fargo college teams. One article stated, "There's little wonder that Tower City has a champion basketball team, considering the way the people of that town stand behind the players." By 1917, the team was being called the famed Tower City High School basketball team, which for years had been known for producing the fastest basketball teams in the state. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
If you believe in the mission of this station, but now's not the right time for a financial gift,
donate a vehicle you don't need instead. It's easy to do, and it could mean hundreds of dollars in support.
Learn more on this station's website.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose a vehicle donation.
And that's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on Main Street, Mary Stoyer has had the job of covering the Dakota Access Pipeline Greenpeace trial. And now that the trial is wrapping up, we'll visit with the North Dakota Monitor reporter to get her firsthand insights. And Madeline will tell us what it means to be expendable as he reviews Mickey 17. And Dave Thompson and I will review the news. That's all ahead tomorrow, right here on Main Street. And we look forward to seeing you again.